I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here today and to make this presentation. I hope that will be enlightening to some people and maybe encouraging to others. I appreciate this university for its willingness to let me come and be on this program. I hope I speak loud enough for you to hear. If you can't hear in the back, well, please wave or something, and we'll see what we can do about getting a... I have to use my notes. I didn't go to Harvard. And I hadn't been to Abilene. So I'm going to use my notes pretty closely because I like to stay with a record as much as I can. And when I begin to ramble, there's no telling where I may wind up. I hope this is... It's not on, but I guess it's... We'll see in a minute if it works. Mary Lemkin Barnes, in some ways, is reminiscent of the beloved Apphia in the Bible. This Christian woman of Colossae was married to a man, Philemon, who was a wealthy slave owner. And she's believed to be the mother of Apphias, a faithful gospel preacher. So it sort of fits the picture that we get of Mary Barnes. The Lumpkins came to this frontier state at a time when Indian towns flourished along the banks of the Alabama River and a massive cane brake covered the great bend in the river between Montgomery and Prattville. Mary Barnes married, or Mary Lumpkin married Elkanah Barnes, a successful planter and businessman, 30 years before the war between the states. The State Archives has in it a painting of Alexander Graham, done by Nicola Marshall, the man who is credited with designing the Confederate flag. The original Confederate flag. But so far as we know, there's only one extant likeness of Mary Barnes. It's a time-worn photograph reproduced in local historical quarterlies. It was probably made in her middle years. However, it's sufficient for us to know how she looked. And here and there we find events in her life that lets us know how she lived. In preparing this memorial of Mary Barnes, selections have been taken from an unpublished series of essays that I've done for the Alabama Restoration Journal, which have not been published as yet. In fact, they haven't even gotten them yet. But the gathering of this information helps us to understand some things about the wonderful life that this woman lived, Mary Barnes. I say this hasn't been published. It really has been. I've got two copies of a King Co. edition for my own personal use. But this reminds us of what William Francesi said about the Lincoln at Gettysburg. He said, "History is a great puzzle for which most of the pieces are missing." And I think that's true, the story of Mary Barnes. Yet we hope to be able to present enough pieces of Mary Barnes' life to paint a word picture of this exceptional pioneer Christian woman known in her community as Miss Polly. Our purpose, mainly, is to tell about the early years of Mary Barnes, especially in the antebellum era of slavery. Great cotton plantations and Cotton was already becoming king in the heart of Dixie when that took place. This corresponds both with the beginning of the statehood for Alabama and the restoration movement in South Alabama. In both of these historic events, Mary Barnes was more than a casual observer. Her husband, Elkanah Barnes, died at the age of 64. He died the year the Civil War began. His death left Polly Barnes, at the age of 50, the holder of 2,434.83 acres of rich land in Montgomery and Lowndes County, and probably one of the wealthiest women in the state. Yet apart from her renowned son, Justice McDuffie Barnes, she would hardly be remembered today. On the other hand, apart from her righteous life, the son may not have become the great gospel preacher that he did. The most trustworthy account of Mary Barnes' conversion that I've found, and I've found several different versions of it, was by J. Waller Henry in Sketches of Alabama Times, published in 1906. This is substantiated by F.D. Srigley in his Life of J.M. Barnes, published in 1898. Both men obtained their information directly from J.M. Barnes, and that's why I think it's the most credible account of her conversion. Henry says the first time his mother heard the plea for a thus saith the Lord, she accepted it, and for years was the foremost defender of the truth in her section. She was baptized by William McGoy, a young Georgia preacher, in a protracted meeting at Fair Prospect in Southwest Hillsborough, or Southwest Montgomery County, in 1828. It was at this time that McGoy established a congregation with 12 members at Fair Prospect, of whom 17-year-old Mary Lumpkin was the first. Fair Prospect was the earliest Church of Christ in Montgomery County. It met in a building at this site for 42 years until 1870, when it was, the meeting house was partially destroyed by fire caused by lightning, and the church then moved to Strata, into a building that was a part of the Strata Academy, furnished by the Barnes family, which was the church. The building was actually given to the church after the school was moved to Highland Home. Thereafter, it was known as the Strata Church. And I find that some historians pass over the earlier part of this and start the church at Strata rather than at Fair Prospect. McGoy was a 23-year-old preacher when he first preached at Fair Prospect. It was part of what Henry calls the Southwestern, or rather the Southeastern movement, which began with a church made up of migrants from North Carolina who split off from the James O'Kelly Reformation. In 1807, The former Okeliites established a church known as later as Antioch at Skull Shoals in Clark County, Georgia. And from that, this movement, in my judgment, arose. I hope I have these synchronized to where they're sort of on ballots. I can't see out of the back of my head very well. And not too well out of the front. In its growth toward a fuller restoration, the Antioch Church, whose influence had spread across Georgia as far west as DeKalb County, reorganized in 1822, and this was near the time that William McGoy was converted. His obituary in the Christian Messenger said Elder McGoy embraced the religion of Christ in his 16th year, and in his 17th year commenced proclaiming the glad tidings of great joy. He died July the 19th, 1830, 3 months before his 26th birthday. In 1822, churches associated with the Southeastern movement renounced the last vestiges of the Methodist Creed, which O'Kelly had clung to, and called themselves Bible Christians. Their influence spread into eastern Alabama, into Russell, Chambers, and Macon counties. Near this time, they merged with the work of Cyrus White, who established the Free Baptist movement in Georgia, before adopting the Restoration and establishing a New Testament church in Cleburne County, Alabama. The Southeastern movement flourished for about 30 years. Time does not permit a discussion of this little-known movement, but it preceded Stone and Campbell in the by several years in Montgomery County. When men associated with Stone and Campbell entered this part of the state, they came from West Alabama and Mississippi. And the Southeastern movement was then absorbed by it and was soon forgotten. And that's why you hear so little about it. The movement is identified by Henry. He's the only historian I know anything about that I've read about that made any mention of it. While others tend to sort of ignore it completely or identify it as part of the Stone movement, which it was not. I get a little dry occasionally. That's not moonshine, but it'll do just about as good. Get what we need about it. Henry says in 1841, a great union meeting was brought about by the efforts of William C. Kirkpatrick. He was Henry's great uncle, so he got his information directly, apparently from his uncle. It was held under an arbor on a hill near Pigeon Creek in Butler County, on the side of the old Meriwether Trail. That nails down the spot pretty quickly, doesn't it? The preacher's presence shows that the men associated with the Southeastern movement and men associated with Stone and Campbell movement, which had already united, seeing that they were teaching substantially the same thing, effected a union. And Henry says the leaven of the union in this great meeting gave the cause new impetus and there were many additions. Both the conversion of Mary Lumpkin and the establishment of the first church in Montgomery County came from the short-lived Southeastern movement, which had been active in Georgia for 20 years before the most prominent preachers of the movement, James Baz, Arthur Dupree, Isham Hicks, William McGoy, and others, became familiar with the writings of Stone in the Christian Messenger. The Southeastern movement actually began nearly 20 years before Stone started publishing the Messenger, through which his influence later came into the movement, and 4 years before the Antioch Church was reorganized in 1822. As for Mary Lumpkin, she knew from her own study of the Bible that she needed to be baptized to please the Lord. And this was before she heard McGoy preach at Fair Prospect. Earlier she had asked a Presbyterian preacher to baptize her, and he refused, saying she had already been baptized as a baby. It must have been a joy beyond measure when that 17-year-old Bonnie Lass first heard McGoy preach at Fair Prospect the very thing she read in her Bible. It's no wonder that she was baptized the first time she heard a plea for thus saith the Lord, and became, it is believed, to be the first person in Montgomery County to be baptized by a restoration preacher, and consequently became the first member of the Fair Prospect Church. That's my conviction, at least in the matter. Mary Barnes married. This picture doesn't fit into what I'm saying. This is a representation of the old Fair Prospect Cemetery, near which the building was located, which is still in existence. The building's not existent, but the cemetery is still there in that part of the county. So I wanted to get that in. This is Elkanah Barnes, and he was having a bad hair day when the camera arrived to take his picture. But he is a very interesting man. See if I don't lose my place here and get where I can get the story of this just exactly where it needs to be. So it was Barnes, she married Elkanah Barnes. This was 3 years after her baptism, and she faithfully brought up her children in the way of the truth. One of the greatest joys of Mary Barnes' life, we're told, was when her son, her only surviving son, she had three that died as children. Very sad life. But when she was, her son was a gospel preacher, she found a great joy in it. And Shrigley says, he never made a sacrifice or endured a hardship for the love of truth as a preacher while his mother lived, that she did not stand bravely by him with gentle, loving words of praise, comfort, and encouragement. When he would come home from after weeks of hard work and preaching tours, she always listened with interest to his story of the hard battles he had fought, and they rejoiced with him over every victory he won, and keenly sympathized with him with every persecution he endured. It was 13 years after the beginning of Fair Prospect Church when Dr. William H. Hooker preached at Fair Prospect. But the people were skeptical of his message. That is, until Mary Barnes, through the respect she had gained as a knowledgeable Bible student, endorsed him in his preaching. And Durden Stowe says she realized from Hooker's first sermon he was preaching the truth, the very thing she knew the Bible taught, the same message she had heard years before from the lips of William McGoy. It's amazing to me how many times young men under 30 years of age contributed great events in their life to the cause of Christ. It would be an interesting study just to study that particular area of the restoration. Young men in the restoration movement. Thirty-one years of Mary Barnes' 80 years was spent as a faithful companion of her entrepreneurial husband, who came to Alabama the year before statehood. He was 21 years at the time, single, and accompanied by his brother-in-law, who married his older sister. And Thomas Butler bought land and built a home and a gristmill on Pentalala Creek, 5 miles north of Crenshaw County. Elkanah also obtained land and built a house for his recently widowed mother, 3 miles south of Butler's mill. This was 4 years after the Treaty of Fort Jackson had opened the lands in Alabama that caused many people in the Carolinas to get an affliction called Alabama fever. Elkanah Barnes remained unmarried for 12 years after he came to Alabama. He felt obligated to help his mother care for 6 minor children, his siblings, ages 4 to 17. It was not until all of these had been married and left home, except one, that he decided to build a log cabin for himself and start his own family. Didn't have to go far to find a suitable wife. I wanted to back up to this map. It's sort of crudely done, but it shows the relationship of where Ann Barnes lived and Lumpkin Hill, where Mary Barnes lived on Lumpkin Creek, and this relationship then to Fair Prospect, where it was located, about 2 miles difference in between each of those places. But the proximity of the Barnes and the Lumpkins evidently provided the environment that led to the attraction that brought about the marriage of Mary Lumpkin and Elkanah Barnes. So on June the 24th, 1830, he found this suitable wife and married her. He was at the time 33 years old, and she was 19. And the part here I was going to skip because I don't want to run over my time too much. I've got Lafayette here, and I want to come back to him in just a moment. But Mary Lumpkin was born in January the 24th, 1811, in Lancaster County, South Carolina. The oldest of the Lumpkins' 3 daughters. She had an older brother but neither his name nor his age are known. There is a photograph in the archives of a Tom Lumpkin dressed up in, as I remember, a Civil War uniform, which would indicate he could possibly have been her niece, her nephew, or her brother's grandson. Perhaps something, may not be any relationship, but don't know, just nothing known about that. But Elkanah was a successful businessman when he married. In addition to be a prosperous planter, he was a corner of a mercantile business with his brother-in-law. He was a surveyor, a land agent, and a building contractor. He built the first mill in Lowndes County and the first two courthouses of Lowndes County and several homes of fine citizens in Montgomery County. He was also active in the militia, and that's why I have Lafayette on the screen here, who drilled at Butler's Mill. In 1825, it was his unit that met the General Lafayette and escorted him to Montgomery on his famous tour when he came to America and traveled over the country for about 16 months and visited the various citizens of the country. And so it's interesting that his life was often touched with history. The lives of both of them were. His home, his first home in Montgomery County, was only 20 miles from the mouth of Pentlala Creek, where in 1540, Hernando de Soto passed by on his trip going through Alabama. Of course, Barnes wasn't there at the time. That was a little before his time. So for for 17 years, Ellie and Polly, as they were sometimes called, lived in a log cabin near his mother's home, where he operated what the family called a farm in the woods. Ever in 1847, they moved into a large plantation-style house with white columns, spacious grounds, and ubiquitous slaves, servants' quarters, a typical plantation and antebellum times. He owned 31 slaves at the time. The plantation was near the Rocky Mountain Road, at a place where a settlement sprang up later that Mary inadvertently named Strada. I'm sure everybody here knows the story of that. But she wanted to name the place Strabo, after a well-known Greek geographer, philosopher, and historian. But her handwriting was not equal to her knowledge of Greek history. And the postal authorities thought she was meant Strada. And they named the post office Strada. And of course, Ellie Barnes was the first postmaster, you might expect. Mary's grandson, E.R. Barnes, described her homemaking in their cabin in the woods, and later in their plantation home in the Strada area. He said, busy though she was as a conscientious housekeeper and a faithful co-partner of a busy man, she found time to brighten her cabin home. And when she was mistress of a really comfortable and roomy house, she made it so inviting and its spirit so hospitable that cultured people were glad to visit in it. She let into her rural home light from the outside world, by providing periodicals and books for her family. She lighted it from within by her own genius of inspiration and instruction that she gave to her household. Her home reflected her nobility of thought and appreciation of culture and progress. Its greatest blessing, E.R. Barnes says, was the vigorous and uniquely interesting personality of its mistress. Mrs. Barnes' word carried the force almost of an oracle with her neighbors who sought counsel and comfort from her. She was pious and abounding in faith in the promise of God. She was frank and she loved truth. Their plantation home, of course it doesn't exist anymore, their plantation home was a place where they entertained both preachers and politicians. Outstanding men that today grace the pages of Alabama history were hosted by them. William Lowndes Yancey, Thomas J. Judge, Thomas H. Watts, David Clopton, and others. Yancey, as a young congressman, as a congressman, was recognized as one of the nation's greatest orators at a time when the city of Washington was resounding with the resonant voices of men like Daniel Webster, Henry Clay, and John C. Calhoun. Watts was a governor. Judge and Clopton were congressmen. Another interesting person that visited in their home was Judge Benajah Bibb. He was the brother of Alabama's first two governors. The judge was a Methodist, whom Mary Barnes, on one occasion when Bibb was guest in their home, undertook to show him the error of his sectarian religion. Bibb made an effort to quote a passage in defense of his faith, but he erred both in its garbled quotation and a misapplication of it. In her gentle and kindly manner, Polly Barnes replied, Judge, I see you know more about politics than you do about the Word of God. Bibb took the rejoinder in grace, and in later years he told in good humor about the time when Mrs. Elkanah Barnes got the best of him in a religious argument. You see the kind of people with whom they were associated. Elkanah Barnes helped rock the cradle of Montgomery County. Mary Barnes. Shrigley related some incidents in regard to the plantation life of the Barnes that seemed to have some bearing on maybe the effect that this had on the life of their son. The parents provided him with a slave, a little older than him, named Ben, who became his companion. She related an event that happened on one occasion when we're told that the slaves had a contempt for poor white people, especially those that are sometimes more derisively called white trash. Shrigley says a poor man lived next to the Barnes plantation or near the Barnes plantation, and three boys of the family rode one shabby old horse without a saddle to school. As they passed by the Barnes plantation, Ben made fun of the boys, and little Barnes joined in the fun making. When Father Barnes came home at night, someone told him Ben and little Barnes had made fun of the poor boys. Father Barnes promptly gave them both a thrashing with the same piece of cowhide, which taught little Barnes a lesson he never forgot. Mary Barnes shared her husband's attitude and compassion for the underprivileged people. Elkanah's blacksmith on his farm was married to a free woman. She did not live on the plantation, but often visited. However, her visit sometimes caused an interruption in the work, and he commanded her to stay off the premises. One day she came to visit while Elkanah was away, and little 10-year-old Mac Barnes took it upon himself to order her to leave. His pompous assumption of authority deeply wounded the poor woman. Her feelings hurt. She was grievously hurt, the feelings, and she wept openly in anguish and humiliation as she departed. At the time, some of Mac Barnes' friends had come to visit with him, spend the night with him. But his mother was sad and troubled. Her countenance was gloomy. He knew something was wrong. His mother usually took great interest in the play when he had visitors. He asked her what the matter was, and she said, go on for now and play, and when you're not so busy, when you're alone, I'll tell you. So he went about his playing, but his sensitive heart would not allow him to play much longer. He had to go back and find what the trouble was. He returned in a burst of sobs, threw himself into his mother's lap, wrapped his arms tightly around her neck, and pleaded with her to tell him what was the matter. Then she told him that she was troubled and sad because he had behaved badly by insulting a poor woman by ordering her to leave the place. He defensively said, well, his father told her to stay off the place and he wasn't there, and so he just took it on himself to do it. His mother said, that's not the business of a little boy, and that should be handled by your father. Perhaps his mother's displeasure distressed him as severely as his father's cowhide. And that became another great lesson that he learned early in life. When young Max left to go off to college, at the age of 17, his mother wrote him a letter. And the record says her heart was heavy and with sorrow to see him go. Her tears fell fast on the paper as she handed it to him. He later tacked the paper in the lid of his trunk, where it remained until it was destroyed by a fire that burned his home in 1883. But he recalled some of the words she said. Be your own self. Never affect to be what you're not. Be kind and courteous to everyone. Be polite and respect those older than yourself. Treat others as you would want them to treat you. Trust God and serve Him, and He'll take care of you. These words, though brief and simple, reflect the life of his mother and summarize the character that she instilled in her son. H. Leo Bowles, who knew young Barnes well, even up into his later years of his life, spoke highly of him. Among other things, he said, "Perhaps no man in the church of our Lord has touched the hearts of so many Alabama people, or people in Alabama, as Brother Barnes. He established hundreds of congregations and strengthened many others." Can you imagine that? I've established one. Did good to do that. There was a lot of help on that. Hundreds of congregations. When Barnes returned from Bethany, he was uncertain about what he wanted to do. He sort of thought about going into farming, as his father was doing. Clyde Fulmer writes these words: "After earnest family conferences, which recognized the community need for a school, Elkanah Barnes decided to build one. He built it with his own funds, on his own land, a commodious frame school building in which his son operated his own school. It's a private school, financed largely by the Barnes family, plus small fees charged to students. None was turned away that could not afford to attend. And all young men who wanted to preach the gospel attended free. It's most likely that when the school as it looked later at Highland Home, after the school was moved there. But it was expanded to become a college. But it's most likely that Barnes, his parents that is, when they instilled in him a respect for poor people and disadvantaged people, which they did in his early life, that this had effect on the way he ran his schools. Those poor white boys that rode to school on a drapid old nag without a saddle was burned into his conscience by a piece of cowhide wielded by his father and by his mother's anguished disapproval at his mistreatment of a poor black woman. Most likely these played a part in his educating many poor Alabama boys and girls to a large extent at his own expense." Dan Vickers, a black tenant on the Barnes farm, said, "When the Creator got ready to make Mr. Mack, he'd done the job himself. He didn't give it out to no clerk to do." God may have not left the creation of Mack Barnes to a clerk, but he put him into the hands of one of the most noble women who ever lived, who left the stamp of her faithful Christian character and life on her son. Bowles said, "May we never forget the work that Mack Barnes did and the consecrated life that he lived." To this we would add, "And let us not forget that little pioneer woman who gave him birth and ably molded him into the paths of righteousness that led him to the great work he did in the cause of Christ." It's been observed that the strong strain of biblical conservatism that yet reigns or prevails in Alabama is something that has been instilled in the state by the work that J.M. Barnes did as a faithful preacher. Perhaps if we had all the pieces of Mary Barnes' life together, we might see that she had a larger part in molding her son's strict devotion to the Word of God than the great sage of Bethany under whom he was educated. He wrote a regular column in the Gospel Advocate called The Little Man. He may have been small in stature, but thanks in a great measure to his little mother, he became a giant in the faith. We close this historical memorial of Mary Barnes with a personal conviction that she was the most remarkable and influential Christian woman in the history of Churches of Christ in Alabama. And she gave to the church and the state, in the person of her son, Justice McDuffie Barnes, probably the greatest gospel preacher in the 200-year history of Alabama. A worthy woman who can find, for a price is far above rubies. And I thank you.